Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, we review Twisters. We have Lee Isaac Chung joining the show, and we have a big debate over the new film, Longlegs.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 315 of Real Blend, a podcast that is constantly telling its listeners, if you can feel it, chase it. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing editor at Cinema Blend and a co-host of the Real Blend podcast, and I've been told I'm the Glenn Powell of the show. On this week's show, Twisters is hitting theaters, and director Lee Isaac Chung is going to join us to discuss. Kev's going to take us down the road of heading out to LA to see Twisters and to talk to the director. But in the meantime, I'm joined in the hosting chairs this week by Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C., and producer Gabe Kovach of the Real Blend podcast. Jakey is on assignment and tornadoes. Ironically, tornadoes That's interfered true. With his schedule.
Yeah.
And pushed back one of the interviews that he needed to grab. So he'll be joining us on another show. But hi, guys. How are you doing today?
Hello, Sean. Hi, Gabriel.
Hello.
Good to be with everybody. Gabe and I are seeing Twisters tonight. Gabe, you're going to Twisters tonight, right?
No. I don't have Twisters tonight.
Oh, okay.
I think just you.
I'm going and I'm getting to bring the whole family. I'm a little bit excited. PJ's girlfriend, Taylor, is in town visiting him. She's been here this week. Came in for the Morgan Wallen show, and then Morgan Wallen decided he was going to be sick and postponed his entire concert. But he determined this last week on Thursday of last week. He was in Tampa and then posted, I'm not feeling very well. I'm going to cancel tonight in Tampa and also next week in Charlotte, because apparently that's what you can do when you're a huge country music star. You can just tell people I'm going to be sick for the next 10 days. So, but in addition, she gets to come to Twisters and she's super excited because like now we see commercials for Twisters and it's like, she turns to PJ and she goes, it says it's opening on Friday, but we're going to get to see it on Tuesday. And he was so much like, it's just another Tuesday for me. Like, you don't understand. Like, it's too not cool. special
it's too cool.
to see something in advance. And that's what happens when you're my son. You become jaded and cynical. So, Kev, in addition to Twisters this week, we are going to get into a conversation about Longlegs. One of the biggest hits of the year, without a doubt, in terms of budget and in terms of reaction to it. Kev, you've seen it twice now. Is that right?
Seen it twice now. I'm very excited to debate you on this one.
And once in 35 millimeter.
Yes. At the Vista Theater.
Where we. Yeah. Oh, I thought you saw it where we host a podcast once. I thought maybe
you
played it there.
Tarantino owns two theaters. He owns the New Bev, which is where we did we did volume 3 with Tarantino interview. And then this is the Vista, which is a classic movie theater that he bought and redid. It's one screen. I think everything's shown on film. This was 35. And they were giving away these like awesome, like limited edition long legs posters that I think there were only 666 of them made. Perfect. And they were all signed by Oz Perkins. And it was cool. I actually didn't go there knowing that was a thing. And then I got out of the movie and they were passing them out. I'm like, oh, wow. Like, hell yeah, I want one of these. And I got a cool picture with the marquee. And it's a really awesome theater. It's like it's not like an ad, but it's like they have old school like candy and sodas. Like they use RC Cola for their sodas. And it's like all the old candies that are no longer available in movie theaters. The popcorn tastes like it did in 1993. it had like the hot dogs taste like 90s hot dogs. Like it's just, it's
as long as it doesn't taste like it's been there since 1993.
No, it just feels like a theater that you would have gone to in the 90s.
That's cool. But
then it's the inside is so extravagant and colorful and like just, and then when the lights go down, it's the darkest theater I've ever been in my entire life. I tried to get up to go to the bathroom at one point. And on the way back, I had to like feel seats to figure out where the hell I was. And I grabbed this dude's arm and I was like, I'm so sorry, man. I can't see anything. And like, it's just, and if you pull your phone out, they have a guy come by and tell you to turn it off. Like, this is like the, like watching like hawks in the corner. It's cool.
It hasn't even been open like a full year yet, right? Didn't it just open last fall?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I think the first thing I saw there was Zone of Interest on 35 millimeter, and it was in you know, obviously a very tough film, but it was seeing it there was it enhanced the sound of it and the design of it. It's a really good screen and a really good projector. So like the film, I feel like, is playing to its fullest potential on that screen and on that sound system.
Now, you tend to know stuff like this. Did they strike a bunch of prints of long legs in 35?
Well, the movie is shot partially digitally and partially on film. So right. I would imagine they did strike some prints. I don't know how many, but with Tarantino's theater, they do these exclusive engagements. I think Long Legs has like a week or something like that. Okay. It's packed. In Long Legs, for people who aren't aware, there's two primary aspect ratios, which is 4:3, and then there's the 2:3:9, which is the wide. The 2:3:9, which is the present day 1993, takes place digitally or shot digitally, and then all the 4:3 stuff is shot on film.
Okay,
which is the memory stuff of the character, which we'll get into when we talk about the plot.
Yeah.
But yeah, that movie is impeccable filmmaking, just on a whole different level.
And I want to talk about shooting on 35 when we get to Lee Isaac Chung as well, too. But yes. Before we get to that, let me just quickly go through plugging the YouTube channel. Thank you very much if you're watching us on YouTube. We're at youtube.com/RealBlendPodcast. Give a like and a subscribe and share the show with a friend. This week is not a newsletter week, but you could still sign up for Real Blend Premium if you want to get an ad-free version of the show. Check the description for information on where you can sign up. This week's guest, we have Lee Isaac Chung, who directed Minari and is transitioning over to Twisters. And he has been talking about, in a bunch of different interviews, you know, the strange transition of that, coming off of like a quiet human indie drama and then transitioning over to a big visual effects driven popcorn blockbuster. But he has talked about the fact that he just has grown up loving those types of films. And I really loved it. So I didn't get a chance to partake in this interview. Jake and Kevin went out to LA to do Twisters. So I got to listen to it as an audience member, as a fan. And I really appreciated him talking about wanting to get back to the outdoors and nature after working on Star Wars. I didn't realize he shot a bunch of episodes of, I think, Skeleton Crew, it sounds like. Oh, Mandalorian he worked on.
I think that's what he said.
He mentioned John Watts too, and John Watts has that Skeleton Crew show coming up through Star Wars. So maybe he did both. But like a lot of that stuff is shot in the volume, and they rely on a ton of LED screens. And Kevin, the junket situation that they had set up, that was LED screens around you guys, wasn't it?
Yeah, with real sets. It was like I posted a picture behind the scenes. I could send it to Gabe if he wants to put it up on the screen. It was basically they had these massive LED screens with like the Twisters logo, but then the movement of the tornado, and then sets were built with like what seemed like hay and like trucks, and it was very cool. Like, it was cool to do an interview on a set like that, because it just kind of felt like you were there shooting the movie with them in a way. But yeah, he was a fascinating interview. Obviously talks a lot about his life and the old school filmmaking that's used in a film like this. And I really enjoyed this conversation.
Well, let me throw it to Lee Isaac Chung, and then there's something I want to talk with you about on the other side, which I found really fascinating about that. So without further ado, this is a spoiler-free conversation regarding Twisters with director Lee Isaac Chung. You can listen to it before you guys go to see the film. You can also press play on it after you've seen Twisters if you come into the show a little bit later on. This is Lee Isaac Chung joining the Real Blend Podcast on behalf of his new film, Twisters.
Thanks so much. I think nerdiness requires time.
Yes, yes, very much so. Very much so. Also, can we just give a quick shout out to Glass Engine and Universal for these? I mean, these sets are pretty incredible. So shout out to those guys.
I was very pleased. I just walked in to see this. This is really great.
And I was also shocked that those are monitors behind us, which is like they're moving, which is very, very cool. Uh-huh. So I want to start out talking about, I know that on the poster underneath the title, it says from the producers of Jurassic World, but I really wanted to see a Twisters poster that said from the director of Minari.
I appreciate that.
Was there ever going to be, was there ever going to be that version of the poster?
No, I never pushed for that, but it is the thing that everyone seems to be asking me, like, how did you go from Minari to this? So it seems like that is in the minds of a lot of people. But I mean, for me, when you look at the poster, you know what the movie's about. And I love that. I love making a movie in which that is the case. And maybe that was one of the reasons why I wanted to jump onto this film, just to make this film based on the original film, looking at Mother Earth and nature, things that are much bigger than me. And I'd like that. I'd like the film itself to dwarf me in many ways. Yeah. That's great.
Well, to follow up with that really quickly, we just had Jan de Bont on the show a couple of weeks ago. And right before he did Twister, he did Speed. And so we talked a lot about what he learned on Speed that he brought to Twister. Did you learn anything on Minari that was relevant for Twisters, or are the two films just two totally different?
Well, they are very different, but I think, so after I made Minari, I went into the Star Wars universe a bit, and I worked with Jon Favreau, John Watts on a couple of their shows, and we kind of filmed a lot in settings like this, where you see these LED screens and things that are animated. I wanted to get back out into the countryside, back out to where I filmed Minari. So that was one big thing that I learned, that there's nothing that you can fake. You can't fake that stuff, like to really be on the ground and filming over there. So the trick for me was to figure out, how do I do that on location and now do it on this scale that is an action-packed, like adrenaline-filled sort of film, which is very different from what I did with Minari. So I think the location element was really key in that regard.
You know, I loved last night seeing it on the big IMAX screen, because you shoot 35 millimeter and it, like, the grain is beautiful. It just looks cinematic, and there's anamorphic lens flares. It was just like gorgeous to look at. But shooting 35 is a great thing, because it really ties it into the way the look of the first film looked. And also just film just has something magical about it.
Yeah.
And Kodak did an entire piece on you guys about shooting behind the scenes, and I was like geeking out about it. Can you talk about the choice to shoot 35? What challenges that gives you, kind of like in the elements? Because obviously you think about so many films for decades were shot on film before digital came along. Mm-hmm. But the choice to shoot on film and kind of what that gave you as an artist.
Yeah, my first two feature films I shot on film.
Yeah.
The first one I did in Rwanda was on Super 16, and then I did a film called Lucky Life on the beaches of the Outer Banks, and that was on 35 millimeter. And both are heavily set in nature. And I just remembered always loving the way that that looked and the way that film would render the natural environment in a very organic and beautiful
like
way.
3D almost.
Yeah, there's something about it. It captures the tactile quality of nature, for me anyway, when I see it. And then I had to move away from film in my work, because budgetarily it's a lot cheaper to work on digital. And with this film, I knew I had a chance to make a push for film and then maybe even establish myself as a director who will always shoot on film.
Hell yes.
So that's kind of what I thought. If I don't make that push now, then I don't know if I'll have that opportunity even later. So this is where I kind of put my foot down, and I felt like I'm going to shoot on film. And
was it a hard push?
It was a hard push, actually. Yeah. Cause I think it's just a lot easier for a lot of people to wrap their minds around the digital workflow. And people just feel a little bit safer. So, you know, generally this business, there is fear about the unknown and unpredictability, and film just adds that little extra level of unpredictability, because you, for instance, you shoot it, you don't know what you're going to get till like a day later. But the way I could mitigate that a bit was to really find a cinematographer who would fight for film as
Dan
well.
Mendel.
Exactly.
One
so
the greatest. He's one of my favorite, because he did Star Trek.
Yes.
With JJ.
Yep. Yes.
He's brilliant.
And his work, that is a very VFX heavy film. But when you look at it, there's some reality to it, right?
The flares on it's gorgeous.
Yeah, there's something that he's doing with that, and tying VFX into that I wanted for this movie.
Yeah.
When I talked to Dan, the first thing I said was, I'd like to shoot this on film. And he said, well, we have to.
Damn right.
And that's what kind of, I said, all right, this is my guy. And then that made it easy to shoot on film, because he was on board.
Right. Love that.
As a quick follow-up to that, like, I always find it interesting to talk to filmmakers about their narrative decisions surrounding shot choices, lens choices, because obviously every decision has a narrative reason. It should, I mean, in terms of filmmaking. But like when you're talking with Dan, because you shoot 239 on this film?
Yes.
Can you talk about like how you, you know, what narrative decisions you put into
that decision, aspect ratio, the lens choices, how wide you're going to go and how close you're going to get? Like, what are those decisions and conversations like with Dan?
Yeah, first we started talking about what kind of movies that we love and the way that we want to present this world. And in a strange way, Thelma and Louise was like one of the first things that we started to talk about.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I think he was a focus puller on that film or something like that. But we looked at that movie quite a lot. And then we looked at other films. And then there's also just what Dan has worked with in the past, like the way that he gets his flares and all of those things.
Didn't they do flashlights in Star Trek? Didn't like they shine flashlights into the lenses with JJ?
Yeah, Dan, I think Dan's very famous for saying he likes to interrogate the lens. And, honestly, there are shots that we would set up. And Dan would still be like, something's missing. And then he sets up a light that's just pointed right into the lens. And it would just add that little level of poetry to the image.
You had a flare in this one after the pool scene that goes up to the sign. There's a huge flare across the screen. It's like beautiful and blue. I was like, hell yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And all of that is very much Dan loves that texture within a shot. So sometimes you wonder, why are these lights on? Because this tornado just hit. Don't think too hard about that. Yeah. It makes it look good. And it's, you know, Dan is doing his stuff.
Yeah.
You have a great sequence that takes place in a movie theater in the final act of this. And the movie that you're showing in that time is Frankenstein. The original film obviously has that great drive-through sequence where they're showing The Shining in the theater at the time. I'm just sort of curious how much thought you put into what movie we're going to be showing on the big screen whenever a tornado hits the theater.
Yeah, that was a ton of thought that went into that. It was in the script that they would be in a movie theater, and I was just trying to figure out what...
But it didn't say what movie would be playing?
It didn't say at all. And as I was constructing the film and figuring it out, something that kept coming to me was that this is really a monster movie.
Yes.
And I love, like, we were making a universal monster movie as well. So for me, like, universal monster movie, my first thought is Frankenstein.
Of course.
So that's kind of where, that was the kernel of the idea that led to that.
Honestly, that's what I got out of it whenever I saw it. And whenever I saw that you chose Frankenstein, I just thought he's making a universal monster movie.
That's so cool.
Did you see, we just drove by, for people who are watching on this on YouTube, we're on a soundstage right now. They recently unveiled the Universal soundstage murals on the side. And Dracula, Frankenstein, I think A Creature from the Black. Yeah. They look fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Definitely a legacy of those films. With this studio. And what was great was once we chose Frankenstein, I was able to really put that into the narrative of the movie as well.
That's awesome.
The depth of field that you had through that screen, I won't say what happens in that scene, but there's like some really cool depth of field usage in that moment towards the end. It's really amazing for people who go see it.
So
you could like put your finger through the screen, it felt like. So obviously practical effects are something that I'm very fascinated to talk about, because obviously there's a lot going on here with, you have to use CG for certain things, of course, but the idea of putting the actors through actual wind and water and things like that, can you just like explain to the audience like what that entailed, like how practical those elements were, that when we're watching actors reacting to physical wind, physical water, driving into a storm, like what was the car being like jolted around during those scenes? Like, how did you film those?
Yeah. The principle behind all of that, kind of where the kernel of all of this started for me, was I was working on Mandalorian after doing Minari, and I hadn't done a lot of VFX heavy stuff. And I remember, my cinematographer on that was Dean Cundey, who did Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
And he was very proud of the moment when the raptors are in the kitchen and it knocks off a few things off of the counter. And he was saying, that was my idea, is what he told me. But what we talked about a lot on that set was VFX, you really make it work by the practical effects around those VFX. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that was always in my head with this movie, and I knew that we needed weather, rain, we needed wind, and all of the effects of what this massive tornado is doing. So we tried to do all kinds of things with that, even like the pool sequence, when you see the trailer that's coming and sliding over, and that Coke machine is sliding, like all these things are being rigged in order to make it feel like this massive force is behind those little objects, basically.
Yeah, because it's like Jurassic Park, like you're saying, like the reason why the T-Rex looks so good is you start on the Stan Winston practical effect, and then you switch to the CG.
Only when they had to.
Right, and the audience just completes it themselves. Yeah. They understand that's it's so smart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it kind of reminded me of going back to the 90s in a way, in a good way, where like it was practical effects and then CGI if we absolutely positively
shout out Frank Marshall, by the way.
You know, a lot of times I feel like with these legacy sequels, you know, one of the hooks is a character is someone's kid, or you know, they're related to them in some way. And unless I completely missed a detail in the movie last night, there are no characters here who, you know, like no one is Helen Hunt's daughter, no one is Bill Paxton's son. Right. I'm sort of curious if there was ever any pressure at any point or any conversation about tying it more into the original than because I mean we were talking about it. I feel like the biggest connection is Dorothy.
Yeah. I'll be honest. At one point, that question was raised: like, what if Daisy's character was Helen Hunt's daughter? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the script was already written and it was already conceived of without that mother character being Daisy's mother. Mm-hmm. But I just couldn't imagine Joe Harding's story being one in which she ends up being this person on a farm and she wishes her daughter would visit more and stuff like that. I felt like that's not a satisfying conclusion to Joe Harding's story.
Yeah.
I just thought, let's just table that discussion. Let's let it be her own self so that we can be free of that. And maybe there's another story there. I don't know. I'm not teasing a sequel or anything like that. I'm just saying, you
Twisters.
Know.
Twisters?
Yeah, at the S. Yeah. But yeah, that's just kind of the thinking process. I wanted these guys to live in their own world.
Yeah. Yeah. So when I was 12 years old, I saw the first Twister. I still have my ticket for that movie.
And oh, my gosh.
And look at the price.
This is nuts.
Ticket. Isn't that crazy?
Do you hold on to
all of
he has
tickets.
All of them.
Yeah, from 95 until about 2005, I have all of my
so
tickets.
Cool.
And the ink on that is still great because now they use lasers and it just fades when you. I have a ticket the other day when I went and saw Maxine. And it's like completely faded already.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. This blows my mind. This is incredible.
The reason I show this to you is because that was a pivotal movie for me. I was 12 and it like, you know, the cow. And everything was just so incredible. Yeah. And now you're directing a sequel of a film that was meant a lot to my childhood. What was the film for you growing up that you remember being a pivotal theatrical experience that was kind of just like, it just kind of rocked your world as a filmmaker?
There were so many of those for me. I wish I had done that. Hang on to those tickets.
His co-host, I also wish I had done that because whenever he does, I'm like, son of a bitch. That's a good idea.
It's so cool jealous. To show them. I show them to the actors nowadays like from their films, and the reactions are just always so cool to see. It's like, I never thought in my mind that I would be sitting across from the person and saying, here's my ticket to your movie from 30 years ago.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That's really, honestly, it's so beautiful. I'd say a lot of the films that I loved growing up were actually Spielberg movies.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That was a...
And you got Amblin on your logo on this one, man. That was cool.
That's
hell.
A cool feeling.
That was always... there's something about Amblin that I always knew when that came up. Oh, I'm going to like this movie. Just when I was a kid. And E.T. was the first thing I saw in a theater.
Really?
So, yeah.
Do you remember the experience?
I even related this to Steven when I finally got to hang out with him. I stood up. I remember watching it and I was standing up and my mom's like, sit down. But I'm like, just like up against the seat in front of me. And cause it was my first time watching a film and to see that story. So I just remember that. And I remember scenes for sure. E.T. going home. That stays in my mind quite a lot too.
The way he shot that moon is an actual moon photography. It was a 1,000-millimeter lens, and then they put an animatronic shot in front of it. So cool.
Yeah, yeah.
But even back then, they were playing with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's really incredible.
So cool.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
One of my favorite pieces of movie trivia is that the original Twister was the very first movie to ever be on DVD. Yeah. It's the very first DVD release. Yeah. Do you remember the first DVD you ever bought?
Oh man, that's a great question. I don't remember the first DVD. I remember, so I really started with VHS.
Oh, sure. Oh yeah, so did we. Yeah, yeah. You know?
But, and I remember my dad would get a bunch of two box sets. So those, I distinctly remember the movies that he was getting that we would watch over and over again, like Ben-Hur, Giant.
Like the two tapes. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. When you get the two tape, you know, it's...
He was a two-taper.
I remember whenever I watched Titanic, I could tell you in Titanic, oh, that's where tape one ended.
Yeah.
I have a weird relationship with the two tapers, where I can like tell you where tape one ended and tape two began.
Meet Joe Black, I remember, was a two taper.
All the Godfathers.
The Godfathers, for sure.
Yeah.
You do it. So one thing I find interesting about filmmaking is sometimes films are either heavy soundtrack films or they're heavy score films. I remember with Tarantino, obviously he was heavy soundtrack for a long time. Then he brought in Morricone for Hateful Eight and went full score. Mm. You balance both here. I think Benjamin did your score for this film. Yes. And then you have also a heavy soundtrack in the film as well. I think I love when you put Chris Stapleton's Arkansas on. I love that track. But when you're dealing with a soundtrack that's also blending in with the themes that Benjamin wrote, what are your conversations about balancing that? Because they have to kind of blend together in a way, right?
Yeah, definitely. So Ben had to be on board from the very beginning, knowing that we're doing this approach with the soundtrack. And he was all for it. He just loved this process of figuring out how does his music slot and how does it differentiate itself from all those needle drops as well. Mm. So that was, it was just constant dialogue, and it also influenced like the instrumentation that he was using in specific moments as well.
How character driven are your soundtrack choices? Because obviously the Arkansas track is clearly for Glenn's character. Mm-hmm. So like how narratively does that fit into the way you decide to play these songs and kind of, because they are speaking kind of to like to the themes of the movie in a bit, but you don't want it to be like too obvious, right?
Yeah. After Minetti, I was really fantasizing, trying to make a film like McCabe and Miss Miller. Like a film that's just full of musical moments and stuff like that. Yeah. So that's kind of been in my mind that I'd love to do a lot more of that. So with the screenwriting process, as I was working with Mark L. Smith, obviously the original Twister has a lot of needle drops defines their character. So we were writing in different songs. Arkansas definitely went in there. I said, please, can you write Arkansas?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I was at a Super Bowl party earlier this year, and I remember, during the game, you know, during a commercial, a lot of times people get up and walk around and stuff. And then the moment that the Twister's spot started to air, everyone paused and turned around. And I remember, you know, because we follow movies, we know that this movie's coming, but a lot of people at my party did not know that there was a new Twisters movie. And all of a sudden, the moment that I think they showed Dorothy, someone goes, holy shit, is this a Twister sequel? And everyone went nuts. Really. And I'm sort of curious if you were watching the Super Bowl earlier this year and if you saw that TV spot live.
Of course. We all knew. We circled that date. We got together, had a party at my place, and we were waiting for that ad to come up.
What is that? What is that like? Like when it's your Super Bowl party and they're doing a spot for your movie?
It's nuts. Yeah. I didn't know how to, you know, even think about it, like what this means. It was incredible to do that and to just feel so excited and good. And my phone just blew up, and there are people from... people who had no idea I was still working, like they're like, "Oh, you're, yeah." They're really excited because people just went in and researched what is this movie, and then they found that I'm directing it, and they texted me. Hmm. So it's
from the director of Minari, I'm telling you, it should have been on the poster, man.
You know, one of my favorite moments in the film is when we experience Daisy Edgar-Jones's character Kate. We experience her, it's a middle school science fair project that she has like in the barn. Mm-hmm. And I love that moment because it made me think about like, you know, the cast and filmmakers. But do you remember a pivotal school project, something that you built like that at all that was related to your own passion for what you do now?
Me and my friends, we did a bunch of little comedy sketches and stuff with a small video camera, something I'll never share to anybody that we would do. So some of that stuff, I realized now that was a burgeoning, that showed that I was really passionate about that storytelling and using a camera and all those things. But I put that away when I got to college. And then a few years later, after I realized I really don't want to go into medicine and stuff like that, I went back to what I loved doing, which was messing around and being a kid. And that's what filmmaking is to me.
What was the moment? Do you remember the moment you shifted, or was it slow, a gradual back into?
I don't know if I could define it as a single moment, but I just remember. I took this class. I had to do this class. Michael Romer. I don't know if you've heard of him. Mm-hmm. He's an incredible independent filmmaker. And I had to do an arts requirement, and I saw filmmaking as art. And I took that class, and every week I was supposed to turn in a video. And as I was doing that, I found that time would just disappear. I would spend all my time on those videos, and I just wondered, what would it be like to live life like this?
Mm, wow.
Just doing this. And that's where the kernel of the idea started. And then at the same time, I was working in a science lab, a genetics lab, and I'm always waiting for time to tick so I could get off work. And it was like the opposite of what I was feeling when I was doing film. Mm. So I just knew this is the thing I want to do. And I don't think I can live life in this way.
Good for you, man. That's really inspiring.
That's so inspiring.
That's incredible. It
makes me think about what I'm doing in my life. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, I know when you watch these movies, there's a lot of, I'm sure, very accurate science in there that you guys get right. But there also is a degree sometimes of like where you sort of have to go like, look, okay, at the end of the day, it's a movie. And if I'm sure a meteorologist can maybe sit down and pick apart this or pick apart that. So as a storyteller, what is the balance between, okay, we have to, this part of the science, we actually really do have to get right versus something where you go, okay, guys, give me a break. It's a movie.
Yeah, this film has both, right?
Yeah.
There, definitely what Kate is finally endeavoring to do is very much science fiction. Mm-hmm. But what I found working on this movie was that I just got so sucked into the science of it and the working with the science consultants and advisors that it was just, I loved putting that into the movie. So we actually tried to be a little more technical than the script was originally calling for.
Oh, interesting.
And put in more jargon and more more detail.
Which I really liked.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I liked learning about it. Yeah, I appreciated the science so much. Yeah.
Everybody behind the scenes was getting into it. Like
that was
cool. VFX guys were just like, we were sharing tornado videos and talking about the science of it. So all the stuff that they're creating in VFX, it's very accurate.
Yeah, and I think a big part of it comes from, in the same way that like as kids we grow up fascinated with dinosaurs, mm-hmm. I also feel like as kids we also grow up fascinated with storms, and specifically tornadoes. Like I remember like being of the age where when Jurassic Park and Twister came out, I mean it was the perfect time to be
absolutely,
you know, 6-7 years old, because those are the things you're obsessed with, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, it's like that shot you have of Kate when she's like looking when they drive into the tornado and you pull out from her looking up.
Yeah,
like that to me is the whole, that's the character right there. That's the entire character in that moment, is like her wonderment for that. I love the moments where she goes out and kind of into the field and for her calming moments to figure out what direction she's going to go in. She has the dandelions and she's like, you know, figuring out what direction, which tornado to go chase. Is there an equivalent to that as a filmmaker? A space that you enter where you're just deciding which direction to go for a shot or a decision narratively? Like, do you feel that you can have an equivalent to what she does in those moments?
Yeah, I love that question. That's such a great question, because I do relate a lot to Kate's character, and in many ways I kept feeling like the underlying story of Kate is that she's a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And she's trying to make
nice.
A massive movie.
Yeah.
And she's trying to make Twisters. That's what I kept thinking. Honestly, what I have to resort to is trusting myself, intuition, these sorts of things, not thinking too hard. And moments like that for me, those are very personal when Kate's doing that. And even what Benjamin Wallfisch is doing in the score in those moments, those are all meant to be more about that artistic process.
Hmm.
So, really glad you pick up on that.
Yeah.
Idea.
I loved it. I love the dandelions moment. Yeah. That was a really cool, because she's in like a field when she's doing those, right? It's like some kind of field or like wheat, and I don't remember the specifics.
It was really fun to film that stuff as well.
Oh, and that one, how did you get the shot of all the wheat bending back and forth? Was that CG or did you get that for real?
It is CG.
That looks so freaking good.
Yeah.
That was
you could have lied and told us,
cool,
no, we waited.
That
we
looked
waited.
Really cool. Remember?
Oh, yeah, it was great.
Do you remember Nolan? Didn't Nolan plant all that corn
for Interstellar?
Yeah.
Great. You know, obviously there are so many moments in the original that we all know and love and grew up with. Is there, as a filmmaker, not saying that we're not trying to say, oh, I would have done it so much better, but is there a moment from the original that as a filmmaker you would have loved to have been behind the camera for, just to know what it felt like to direct that particular moment?
One thing that I kept shaking my head about with how did he pull this off is that aerial helicopter shot that ends up finding Bill Paxton and Jamie Gertz. Like, that is such a crazy shot. I got to work in a helicopter for the first time on this film. It's not easy, you know.
Sure.
It's really so much has to happen, and the way that they timed that, it's an epic shot. That's
and timing's the right word, because like everything has to be in just the right place at the right time.
It's a chef's kiss shot, that one. Yeah. They really spent a lot of time on it on screen in the edit. You can see that they really preserved it, and I know it's because they're so proud of what they pulled off as well, because that's a hard shot.
I love that you can watch a movie and just know the purpose behind why they let a shot go, just because you as a filmmaker know, in the same way that I guess we would probably do for like news stories and stuff. Just like, I know what it took to pull that off. That's why they let the shot go along. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, much respect to him, totally. Even for the whole film, I mean, what he pulled off is really incredible.
Yeah.
It's cool you guys talked to him, by the way,
though. Oh yeah, we had 2 weeks ago? Yeah, we had him on.
Cows and everything.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
But one thing I find interesting about your film in particular is, you know, at the end of the day, this is a summer blockbuster, and the twisters themselves are monsters, but there's an entertainment value to what they bring to an audience in terms of intensity. But you focus also a lot on the damage that is done to people's lives, having to kind of the cleanup aspect of it, saving people. And I think that's a really tough balance to find, because you're trying to entertain an audience, but you're also trying to say, listen, these things are actually really dangerous at the same time. They actually ruin people's lives. Money is, you know, lost and everything. Can you talk about finding that balance in a summer blockbuster where you're trying to entertain at the intensity level, but also kind of going, this is not really a fun thing for people as they go through their towns?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I just think about my audience. Who's the audience for this film? All the people who are watching. It's not people who are safe away from these storms. I'd love for people who even this is their reality to be watching the movie and to be enjoying it, and knowing that we are honoring and understanding what people are living through and going through. So I think it kind of starts there. And then I grew up in Arkansas, and we definitely faced quite a weird disaster with, put it in Minardi, the big fire.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
I remembered like what that was and how that felt. So I just wanted to make sure that we keep a sober side to what we're doing, not just let it be entertaining.
You're not exploiting it. You're
exactly.
You're using it in an entertaining way, but also an educational way.
Yeah, and not to wallow in it either.
Yes.
Like not to let it just sit. Because the truth is, I met so many people in Oklahoma who have lived through tornadoes, have lost things within tornadoes. But they were like, let's make this movie. And they were having a great time behind the scenes, and background actors wanting to make this movie. I love that spirit. And I was hoping that this film would capture that balance.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
You know, we live in an industry now where if a movie's a hit on opening day on a Friday, by Sunday, the studio has announced part two coming next year kind of thing, which blows my mind that it has taken us almost 30 years to get this movie. You know this industry better than we do. Why do you think it took 30 years for them to finally come around and do a second version of this?
You know, I think with this one in particular, it really rested with Steven. He loves that first movie, and he has he wanted to protect it. He wanted to make sure that it was right before he said yes. I think it was always in the works that different people were.
Paxton wanted
seeing,
it. Right?
Yeah,
oh, did he?
I think
yeah.
Many different people, and I, you know, this has all happened before me. But I just know that Steven takes it very seriously before he agrees to continuing something onward. So that's just what I noticed working.
I would just like to end really quickly. What is it like to casually hang out with Steven Spielberg? he's my favorite filmmaker of all time, and I don't think I could do it, because I would just turn into Chris Farley and just be like, dude, remember when you made Jaws? That was awesome. Like, I couldn't do it.
I don't know if I'm revealing too much with this.
It's
I might regret myself. Yeah. So the first times I would talk to him, I don't find myself getting starstruck with other people, actors. Right. Like I tend to be okay, but with him, after I talked to him, I'd have to unwind.
Yes.
Just be like, I just talked to Steven Spielberg. Yeah. But he's just so down to earth that I think subsequent times it just started to normalize. But there are still moments where I would be like, I'm starstruck right now. This is weird. Snap into it.
Yeah. You
know?
Yeah.
It's just reverence. Like, I really revere what he's done, and he means a lot to me.
He is cinema.
I would like to point out that we just got the wrap, but the wrap that we got was this,
which
feels nice. So perfect for this movie.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for joining our show and for talking filmmaking with us, and I hope to have you back sometime in the future. So,
yeah,
thank you. Yeah,
this great conversation.
Fun.
I appreciate you, man.
Thank you.
So, that was really great. Thank you so much.
We want to thank both Lee Isaac Chung and our good friends at Universal for getting him on the show. Kev, the aspect that I wanted to talk to you about with regards to this is how he decided that this was going to be his one opportunity to push to shoot on film. And I found that to be really fascinating of directors who are figuring out their place in the industry and when they get a chance to make an ask like that. You know, like we talk so much about like, why don't more people shoot on film? When do you get an opportunity to? And hearing him talk about that struck me as somebody who, you know, kind of understands this is my one shot. This is a rare opportunity for me to establish myself as a director who's going to want to shoot on film whenever a chance I get. And it really moved me because you could tell it was super important to him, you know, and for him to be like, I want to find a cinematographer who also wants to shoot on film. I want to work with a crew that wants to do this. And on a picture like Twisters, which I haven't even seen yet, but can kind of understand the risk of shooting on film, because he says, and my stomach kind of dropped when he said it, like, you don't know what you have until a day later. You know, you don't know if you got what you need. And this is a big, expensive film to go shoot, you know, in the outside and discuss the elements and shooting on film lens. But, you know, at the same time, if you want to go back and listen to one of our previous interviews with Jan de Bont, you know, he talks about the amount of effort that went into filming the original. So why wouldn't you shoot something like this on film? So I just wanted you to talk about that and how directors kind of have to kind of early in their career pick their moments if they're going to try to become somebody who wants to make it a regular thing that they're shooting on film.
Well, it's also important to know, like, and this is kind of reminds me of the whole idea of where we are now in the television landscape of binging and how a lot of studios are going back to the week to week thing. And that seems almost crazy to think about. Like, well, we did that for decades on television and it worked. Mm-hmm. Like the majority of film history was shot on film. Like, I don't want to give an exact percentage, but I would, Gabe, 80% of the film history has been shot on film. I would assume.
Yeah, it's probably something like that.
Maybe it's skewed
because digital allowed for even more to be shot. So maybe like by volume, it's not as, but over time, yes, over the last 100 years or so, 100 something years.
And so you think about, like, you know, that's how film started. That's how things were made. People did everything they could. I mean, look at old Buster Keaton movies. You utilize the tools you had, and the necessity was the mother of invention. You found ways to intercut. I remember talking to Damien Chazelle for Babylon. We were talking about, like, you know, sets he would love to visit at some point. He goes, could you imagine like being on the Wings set? And like, and he was talking about the idea of like when these guys and these filmmakers started figuring out how to intercut things and when to go to a close up and all these things, like back in the day, he called it like punk rock. And so I think in terms of shooting on film, I think one of the things that I hear a lot that I don't know that I agree with or know enough knowledge to disagree with it is that it's more expensive to shoot on film. I hear that sometimes, and then I hear filmmakers say that it's actually not that much more expensive to shoot on film versus digital.
I think it's definitely more expensive.
But is it that much more expensive?
I don't know. The ones that talk about it being expensive talk about it being that much more expensive.
Yeah.
It's also, you know, there's a scale of like, if you're low budget, then you're low budget. If you have $150 million, then, you know, the difference maybe is effectively small. Sure. But you have to think about also, to Sean's point earlier when he's talking about, you know, you don't know what you got till the next day. Mm. There's the exponential cost of fixing problems, which is what you're doing on set all the time. And that can become very expensive, let alone just the material cost and the processing cost.
Let me also throw in a little anecdote that I got from earlier this week, which is I participated in a press conference for the movie The Young Woman in the Sea with Daisy Ridley. And I asked the director, Joachim Roening, about shooting her in the actual open water and the amount of takes that it takes. Right. What he talked about at length is the amount of planning and preparation that they did with body double swimmers to get to the point where he knew where he wanted his cameras to go so that when they had to capture her, they had to capture her. And I think on a bigger budget film that's going to shoot with film that knows they have X amount of film to work with, they have to build all that planning into their schedule type thing. as opposed to maybe an indie director with shooting on digital who can just roll with it and go. Like, if you think about the amount of stuff that has to go into the planning to make sure you get the film you get, because even he talked about shooting her in the ocean. They would have these elements with these boats that are like planning her trajectory, and then she'd get in the water and the current would take her way off to where they thought. So
I would argue that film, again, everyone knows who listens to the show, I prefer film over digital. I also don't hate digital. I understand digital. There are a lot of filmmakers who shoot digitally very well. David Fincher is one of them. You know, I have no problems. I'm not sitting on a high horse, but I do believe that, to the point you're making, more planning would go into the filmmaking, like in the sense that, like, I would argue that if you're shooting on film, that you have to be maybe more meticulous about the decisions you're making and the specific choices that you're making.
That's more of a philosophical conversation versus like the cost of it, I think.
I get that. But also, but if the majority of film history was shot on film, a lot of water films over in the ocean have been shot on film. Like, we've seen a lot of movies that take place in the water in film over the years. Dunkirk was shot on film. I mean, like there's just a lot of different aspects to, I think what
Spielberg could do it. Anyone could,
but you use the limitations that you have to your advantage.
Sure.
I mean, it's the entire reason why Jaws is so brilliant, because the shark broke down right, and they couldn't show the shark. So why don't we use that to our advantage and make it scarier?
We've had that discussion before. It's a fair discussion. I think it's a different discussion. Yes. I think there are benefits philosophically to shooting on film. There are benefits philosophically to shooting on digital.
Yeah.
As much as you could say that there's, you want to put emphasis on planning, on being meticulous and detailed, there's also emotionally, in a film, you can feel when it's shot guerrilla style. You can feel when they found it in the moment. You can feel when they made that micro adjustment and they got it and they were able to make the adjustments in post that they couldn't make, or they were able to more quickly capture that. Like, it depends on your story. It depends on the filmmaker. It depends on their style. But again, I think what we were originally talking about was the elements that can go into cost that maybe none of us are super qualified to discuss, because they're not always transparent about that. But
yeah, and I want to clarify that, because like I hear both sides. I hear that a lot. And I'm not saying one side's wrong or the other, but I have heard filmmakers say that shooting on film is not that much more expensive than shooting digitally. But I don't want to, like, you know, I don't know for sure. I've never made a movie on film or digital at the level that we're talking about. So I don't have that knowledge. But what last thing I'll say about it is this, like there is, and it's, I feel like people try to say that it's a romanticizing nature of it, but there is something about film that just looks like cinema. I'm watching this Twisters film on an IMAX screen. It's the same screen that Nolan uses in AMC City Walk, where it's an 8-story IMAX screen. And when you blow an image up like that on an IMAX screen, the 35 just sings. Like, it's like you could just, it looks like you're watching a film. It looks like you're watching a movie that was shot in the 90s. It just feels like you've been transported to the world of film. My problem with digital, and not a lot of people do digital well, in my opinion. There are ones who do it well. Obviously, Deakins does it well. Skyfall is one of the best digitally shot films I've ever seen in my life. It looks remarkable. Same with Sicario.
Did Garland shoot digital for Civil War?
Yeah.
I mean, that was fantastic.
Right, I know. And people do it well. But there are times where digital looks like TV and it looks like real life.
Sure.
And I have a hard time I have a hard time staying immersed when I'm watching something that's so high def, because to me, the world of cinema is not the world I live in. It's transporting me to a different world. And I also understand that the aesthetic of using digital, like Garland shoots digitally on Civil War because he wants it to look like news footage.
Sure.
Civil War is meant to look more like real life than a movie.
Like Gabe said, philosophically, that was his decision.
Right.
That's his approach.
There's decisions. And that's why with Long Legs, they use 35 and digital. Ready Player One was a great example of that. Let's shoot 35 in the real world. Let's shoot digital in the Oasis. And then that juxtaposition between back and forth of the perfection of the Oasis versus the imperfections of life on 35 is kind of the brilliance of it. You know,
again, I mean, I think ultimately, I don't think there's any way anyone can be sort of empirical or can be sort of definitive in saying this is the way.
Right.
All we're describing is that there are tools
Yes.
And it depends on the artist, how they use their tools.
Yeah. And you can also add grain now. I mean, listen to our James Gray interview for Armageddon time.
But also, like, I mean, but also, like, there's, not to keep having this discussion, that's also a product of, you talk about film history, think about your, like, your introduction to movies, what movies looked like to you versus someone who's maybe having that experience now,
yeah,
who's seeing cinema on their phone, who's seeing cinema,
yeah,
you know, on their TV. Like, it's not to invalidate their emotional response to that, but they're built, that's where they're building their sort of chest of emotional, sure, experiences that are going to bring them the nostalgia and bring them the, sure, that's what that is in my mind.
And that's a generation that we need to sort of pick up the baton and carry it.
Yeah. Luckily, a lot of filmmakers in modern time, Nolan, Tarantino, Scorsese, they still shoot on film. J.J. Abrams, like, so this generation is still getting that. Chung.
This is a little bit to come back around to my conversation.
Safdie Brothers, yeah, it's like
people another director film. Who wants to, you know, make it a point of, yeah, all right, well, but in addition, Kev, let's switch over to our Twisters review.
Yeah.
You had me at lens flares. Are there some gorgeous lens flares in this movie?
Great lens. I mean, Dan Mendel's one of my favorite DPs of all time. He works with J.J. Abrams a lot. I mean, I still think some of the shots I remember seeing on the Enterprise in the first Star Trek that J.J. did, like the way Dan would like shine flashlights into like the lens and get those gorgeous flares, that silver.
I just rewatched first Trek like so 2 weeks ago.
Oh,
I love that movie. Oh,
that Hemsworth that opening so makes me cry when that Giacchino score hits and all the, yeah, sound drops out.
It's funny. It's been so long. I feel like JJ's become underrated, maybe just because he hasn't put something out in a while.
Yeah, yeah.
I think people don't appreciate how fucking good Super 8, Star Trek.
Super 8 is...
Mission Impossible 3.
Mission Impossible 3, Star Wars, Force Awakens.
Force Awakens is tremendous. Yeah.
Incredible. No,
he's great.
Yeah, if you want to sit down and be entertained for 2 to 3 hours, like, he knows how
but
to do
that. But it's hilarious. It's like, okay, so Star
Lost,
Trek is great. And I like Into Darkness. I don't think Into Darkness is terrible. It has a couple of bad decisions throughout it.
Sure.
But it's still entertaining. You know, I think all
the
three of those
Star
Trek
movies
are
fun. The first one, I think, though, is just inarguably entertaining.
So great. Yeah. And then Rise of Skywalker is bad, but Force Awakens was great.
Yeah, by the time they got to Rise of Skywalker, I mean, that was a mess. There's no saving it. There's no saving it.
That's a behind-the-scenes mess rather than him. Yeah,
without a doubt, yeah. Kev, talk to me about Twisters. How is it as a summer blockbuster? How is it as a continuation? Is it even a continuation of the story, or what's the deal here?
I mean, it's obviously in the same world because I don't even know if... I don't know. I don't want to get into spoilers.
Sure.
But there is a reason why it exists in the same world as Twisters, Twister. But it's different characters. It's new characters. I thought it was fine. So okay. My review is very middle of the road. The original Twister for me, I saw when I was 12 years old. I rewatched it the other day. It still holds up. Mm-hmm. That film has so many iconic cinematic moments, like moments that I think about a lot when I think of movie making, the tornado going through the Shining drive-in theater, the cows. And Jake and I were talking about this because Jake and I had very similar thoughts on Twisters after we got out of it. And like the original just still hits. It's so good. And Bill Paxton is incredible. Philip Seymour Hoffman, Helen Hunt.
Sporting cast is amazing.
Incredible. Yeah. To me, the best thing about Twisters is Glenn Powell and Daisy Edgar-Jones.
Okay.
And I thought Anthony Ramos was great too. Their performances are excellent. The world that they're in, the script that they're dealing with, and the storyline they're dealing with, I don't find is up to par with the performances that they were giving.
Is it cheesy? I just rewatched the trailer and it came across a little hokey. That's why I led with that line of,
you know how there's like, you know how like sometimes like a movie like from like Twister, for example, it hit a good tone where it was serious, but it was also fun, and it wasn't, I don't know, it's hard to explain. This one almost doesn't know how to balance its tone. It feels like it's like it when it's trying to be over the top, it actually doesn't land the over the top. It actually comes across like it's not well written in a way.
Horny. Yeah.
I think, and Jake and I were saying this, there's not really any memorable moments that I could sit here and recall to you about like a big moment where a tornado did something crazy like it did with the cows or it did with the drive-in theater.
Okay.
It feels a little too long. Right. There were moments where I was like, this is dragging a bit. They could have cut it down, I think, by like at least 15 or 20 minutes at least.
Well, the first one has the brilliant escalation of like, you just know you're getting through increasingly more dangerous tornadoes.
Right. And this one, again, I won't spoil anything. This one, I feel like, doesn't have that buildup.
Interesting.
Okay. This one does a lot. The one thing I will say this one does a really good job is it actually highlights the real danger of what these things do to small towns and to people as they rush through. And I think the first one, I think, was more, at least in my opinion, more of like a summer blockbuster. It was, you know, the tornadoes are monsters as they are here. Sure. But I think this one focuses a lot more on the people on the ground that it affects, the families, the businesses and all those things like that. So it's not just, we're not just viewing the whole thing through the characters' lenses. We're actually on the ground through the damage. So that to me was a really interesting highlight that I thought was fascinating to the film, to because there's this idea that, you know, when you're making a movie like this, this is real life for a lot of people, you know, and the idea of exploiting, you know, a tornado as an entertainment piece for a movie.
Yeah.
Is an interesting conversation to be had because there are people whose lives are destroyed.
Do they want to go to the movies?
Right.
And experience this as a getaway.
This time of year, especially though, is such an interesting bit of time.
And to me,
in the '90s, just to interfere real fast, there were a lot of disaster movies, you know, like you would have Volcano, you know, and The Day After Tomorrow, you know,
Armageddon.
There were like weather related disaster pictures where we went through a run of them. So Twister didn't stand out necessarily. It was just another way that somebody was using a natural disaster.
It was, I guess, from that list, though, it's the most like actually happens, like Volcano in the middle of where was that set? Like Los Angeles or something?
Los Angeles.
Or like obviously
Day After Tomorrow. I think it was like the La Brea Tar Pits or something like that.
Yeah.
They woke up.
So I want to give Lee credit, or Lee Isaac Chung credit for that, because I think that's something that I found to be really humanizing to the story. Because in my opinion, like, that is something that I did think about when I walked into that film, because I'd been seeing stories about tornadoes that have been happening recently. And I'm like, how are people going to feel about like this being an entertainment piece? But then so the movie does a really good job, in my opinion, and it gave me a lot of insight into really that, you know, we think we hear stories about a tornado hitting and we see the footage of it on our computers and, you know, on our phones and everything like that. But then to be on the ground with these characters as they're helping people get away from it or helping people clean up their towns, that stuff I thought was really interesting. So I didn't love the film overall. I thought that the story wasn't as compelling as the original. I do think Glenn and Daisy are fantastic together. I think Anthony Ramos is great in it, but I just found it to be a bit forgettable in terms of like what it was trying to do from a blockbuster perspective.
Okay.
I don't think that there's a single scene in the film outside of one scene in a pool that I thought was memorable in terms of what it was trying to complete in terms of intensity. Mm-hmm. It just felt like it was like one note.
Okay.
I never felt like I was building towards a climax in a way. Okay. It's fine. It's fine. It's not bad. It's not great. I think I'm in the minority a little bit. I think a lot of people are loving it.
People seem to be having fun with it. Yeah.
Make up your own mind for it.
Jake say coming out of the screening? He liked it.
Jake and I were in the same boat. I don't want to put words in his mouth, we were in the same boat of thought. But I also think
disappointed. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that I rewatching the original prior to this, the original just
works.
It's different. The characters are better. The story is better. Like, you know, the whole emotional arc of Helen Hunt and that whole, you know, and like Jake brought this up. He goes, one of the best things about the original Twister is like, the whole movie is basically Bill Paxton trying to get Helen Hunt to sign the divorce papers.
Right. Yeah.
And that's like a whole through line in terms of him, but he gets sucked back into the world of tornadoes. This one, as Jake was saying, doesn't really have anything like that.
Hook. That's a good emotional hook for the story to run through. So this is interesting too, because the minute I found out we were going to be able to get PJ and Taylor into the screening tonight, Michelle was like, good, let's watch the original beforehand. And I was like, no, because they haven't seen the original, and I kind of want this to be their first experience with it. I think it's going to help them like it more, you know, like if they don't have the original compared to, and they just go into this one, maybe they're going to find it a little bit more exciting because they don't know what's coming. But
yeah,
I don't know. I'll be curious to see what their reaction is, having not seen the first one at all. But all right, we're going to throw it to a really quick ad break. In the meantime, check the description on wherever you guys get your podcast needs, Matt, because earlier, as I mentioned, we had Jan DeBont on discussing the original Twister, which is coming out in a 4K version that is on shelves right now that you guys can grab. And I can personally tell you guys has some really great behind the scenes featurettes in terms of the making of Twister. And also Jan DeBont is just a legend. And when he came on, he talked about Speed and Die Hard and a ton of other really great films that he was partaking in. So make sure you go back and listen to that right now. We will be back on the other side of this ad break to break down the horror sensation that is Long Legs. And we are back. Okay, so the second place movie at the box office this previous weekend, behind only Despicable Me 4, which was an obvious behemoth that families were going to go out of their way to go see, was the marketing hit and crowd pleaser Long Legs. Critically acclaimed crowd pleaser Long Legs. Tremendous to see a horror film from Neon pushing it. It crossed $20 million, I want to say.
22, I think.
22. I mean, just an outstanding win for them in terms of like, because the marketing had to go out of its way to kind of hide the hook of the movie, which is Nicolas Cage's look as the main character, Long Legs. And we, the Real Blend co-hosts, were super fired up to go into this movie. Jake and I both went out of our way this weekend to go see it over the weekend. Kevin, like he mentioned, went to go see it when he was out in LA, basically landed in LA and went right to the movie theater to go see it. And that was for your second time through, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, so going back to our discussion about film, you know, call me what you want a romantic about it, but there's nothing to me that is better than watching a movie projected on film, let alone shot on film. And I had an experience with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood where I saw it twice on 35, then I saw it on 70, and the 70 pushed it to my favorite Tarantino movie of all time, because you're getting the highest quality image and sound essentially from, you know, in a way from what Tarantino really made with his, you know, he shot 35, but they blew it up to 70 and it looked incredible. But to see Long Legs in 35, knowing that it was partially shot 35, I'm telling you, man, just something as simple as a cigarette burn as the reel changes. It's just like, it feels like you're watching a movie. It's hard to explain. I don't really know how else to say it, but it is to see a film like that at a theater like that, that is specifically designed in pristine projection. I understand that's the biggest problem with film projection today. Most people don't know how to make or build a film.
If you're going to Tarantino's theater, it's being broadcast.
You know, it's being done well, most people around the country, like if someone were to go to a movie in, like, I'm just going to randomly say Alabama.
Sure.
There might not be someone there who knows how to run a film projector the way I'm talking about. So I am seeing it in a very, very, very specifically precious environment for the material.
But so we're going to get into a conversation about this, because I went to go see it Sunday night and I'm the outlier of the three of us. And I'm bummed that Jake's not here for this, because he thinks it's probably one of his favorite movies of the year. He says it's going to make his top 10 for sure. It might even make top 5. And I came out of it severely, severely disappointed. And so we're going to have a conversation about Long Legs. Now, this is going to be a spoiler filled conversation. This is something that literally you should only be listening to it after you go see the film. And I highly recommend that people go check it out, because it is absolutely worth seeing on the big screen, regardless of my problems with it. Because as I'm going to say to Kev, and here we begin the spoiler conversation of it, I'm not going to disagree with any of the things that you're going to tell me about how beautifully shot it is. It's a fantastic looking film. The performances are great. Like, I thought Cage was amazing. I think Micah Monroe is fantastic in it as well, too. Who's Alicia Witt plays the mother?
Yep.
Plays the mother. And we can talk openly about their roles in this. Like, I think all of that is great. I think all of it is in service of a story that to me is deeply, deeply flawed. And I'll tell you the one thing that took me completely out of it, since we're able to talk spoilers, is that the movie hinges on this girl being the FBI agent who was assigned to the case, you know, of the person who visited her when she was 9 years old and whose mother is the accomplice to the killer. I couldn't get past that. Like, that to me is so ludicrous. It's Why? So ridiculous of a stretch.
It's perfect.
It's not like I can't. That's legitimately the equivalent of getting to the end of Silence of the Lambs and being told that Buffalo Bill is Clarice's father. Or if John Doe in Seven is related to Brad Pitt somehow.
I knew she was the kid at the beginning of the film.
Yeah, but I'm saying it's okay. It doesn't matter when it's revealed. I think it's a bad that's a bad coincidence. Like, that takes me out of the story so drastically.
Cage completely covers that. So what you're referring to is the beginning of the film, a young girl is visited by Longlegs. Yeah. And essentially later on in her life, at age 20, she decides to go into law enforcement. He says this to her in the interrogation room at the end of the film.
Yeah.
The fact that she went into law enforcement was such a crazy coincidence for him that he had to manipulate her from that point forward. And right. I thought that was a really interesting, it's not like he like thought to himself, oh, she's going to go into law enforcement when I see her at 9 years old. He even says to her, it's like, it was funny. What does he say? It's funny to me that you went into law enforcement, whatever he says to her,
right.
Because he was able to utilize her in his web of destruction in a way. It was kind of interesting, I thought.
See, that plot reveal ruined the movie for me. Like, I was with it. I was digging it. Like, I couldn't wait to find out what it was. I don't even mind Satan balls, you know, in the doll's brains. Like, I think that's pretty far-fetched. I would have preferred a little more grounded, you know, explanation to why Longlegs was doing what he was doing. Satanic balls that are communicating from quote unquote the man downstairs is a bit of a reach for me. I guess I was disappointed in the fact that it took such a supernatural turn.
Yeah.
So to me, that's the bridge too far. The bridge too far was the fact that she's assigned to the same case, and that it was her mother who was helping with the thing. So you've seen it twice, and that never bothered you?
No. I thought that was I think the entire concept of the film, that doesn't bother me one bit. I actually think it's a fascinating way to play with, like, the manipulation of the character of him being the serial killer and her being an FBI agent, to me, is what makes the film fascinating.
Okay.
Like, she's slowly unveiling his plan, and it's meant, the entire thing is orchestrated by him. Like, everything that happens is designed to happen the way it does. And, like, okay. I just think it's interesting to think about every single moment of her life post that day when he visited her has been manipulated by him in some way.
So does that become more evident on second viewing? Because didn't get all that the first time through.
Oh, yeah. Remember, like, at the end of the film, you realize that Longlegs has been living in the basement of her house the whole time.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, like, every little detail comes around full circle. Like, the moment she has that on the phone with her mom at the beginning, when she asks her mom why it takes her so long to get upstairs to the call, that all comes back full circle. We realize later on that the mom's been downstairs working on the dolls with Nicolas Cage's character. And it's just all, it's so impeccably designed and disturbing and just, I don't know. There's something evil about that movie. It just has,
okay.
It feels like it was made by, it feels like it was made with pure evil. Like,
let me ask a question then.
That's how it feels.
Does the movie have a better explanation for what the balls are and like where they kind of come from? Because that went over my head completely too.
Yeah. I mean, the whole concept is that Satan is in, if you watch the film again, there's a lot of moments where Satan appears in the movie. I don't know if you saw Satan film.
Well, like a shrouded figure with like the yellow eyes that kind of pop up, and
that's the dolls.
Oh, is that the dolls?
There's also moments where like she looks out into the woods and she sees Longlegs in the woods, and then above him is a dark figure of Satan above his head.
Caught that.
And so I think I think the explanation is that he actually is working with the devil. That's why he says Hail Satan. I think he literally is working with the devil. So what's happening is he's inputting part of himself into every one of these silver balls, and whatever magic is conquered conjured from that is put into these dolls, and the dolls are then taking over and making people kill each other. And
so when the medical technician holds the wand up to the ball,
yeah,
and it produces that feedback soundish thing.
Yes.
And he says something along the lines of like, I swore I heard my ex-wife's voice coming through this. Is that because like his ex-wife is Satan or like manipulated by Satan?
I think the ball is using the fears and insecurities or whatever of that guy's life to manipulate him in some way. I think it's just like, I found it to be that Nicolas Cage's character was working directly with the man from downstairs, or the man was the terminology he used. The man.
Did you just say the man downstairs?
The man downstairs. Yeah. I think he was directly working with the devil, and the devil was involved in the making of the dolls. And those dolls were then put into a place where they could manipulate the people in their homes to kill each other, essentially.
Okay. Now that also is a leap of logic that I had a really hard time figuring out, which is him finding enough victims whose birthdays were on or around the 14th.
Yeah.
At age 9. You know, these are stretches where if the movie's working for you, you can go with them. You know, you generally don't mind the details like that. I'm sure if I go back and rewatch Silence of the Lambs, there'll be things where I'm like, wait a second, you know, hold right. on. How did Buffalo Bill really do this? But in the moment I was like, I don't know. That's a leap. That's this is a big leap for me to take.
So I know we're in spoilers, but I actually want to just say a couple of things. I love this film. I think it's a masterpiece. I think Micah Monroe and Nicolas Cage are brilliant. I think the performances are incredible. Cage is unrecognizable. The makeup is insane. The interrogation scene that happens between him and Micah is one of my favorite scenes I've seen in a film in a long time. I think the film builds tension well. I think it actually leaves an imprint on you. You leave thinking about it. At the end of the day, the questions that you're asking are things that I don't necessarily find that I need full answers to.
Okay.
I'm giving my explanation as to what I think they mean, but my experience of the film is more, I'm more with the film and just taking in the story the way that Oz Perkins is telling it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not questioning every detail. I don't need to know the subtlety and the nuance to the technicalities of why the ball works or why the black smoke works, or I'm not really bothered by that. I'm not bothered to know the scientific nature of why these things are happening or why there's a random connection between the, you know, to me it all just feels like the whole movie feels like it's designed by Longlegs. And like the camera is like, I saw a tweet that it was like the camera's pretty static the whole time. It's almost like a point of view perspective as you're watching everything happen, and he shoots it super wide. There's so much tension in every frame. The use of the 4:3 for memory and shooting on film, and then the expansion of that ratio as it goes out to the 2:39 as we enter into 1993 at the end.
Let me bring up one quick thing.
Yeah.
Because the movie opens in the 4:3.
Mm-hmm.
There was a moment where I was like, this whole movie better not be in 4:3.
I love 4:3. Because
it opens up at the opening credits, essentially. But you go through that whole first sequence in 4:3, and I was like,
yeah, but oh, the God, box format was so great. It looked almost like 3D. This is a very disturbing film and a very dark film that I feel has still stuck with me ever since I've seen it. I think Kiernan Shipka's performance is incredible. She plays the character in the when she goes to visit her in the institution.
Oh, is that who that is? Okay, cool.
Yeah. And I think it's just a really, really well done film. And I love it. And if people aren't familiar, Oz Perkins is the son of Anthony Perkins, so Norman Bates from Psycho. So there's a lot of horror built into his DNA. And he has really kind of, to me, made a film that was unique, different. I didn't know what was going to happen. I thought it was fascinating. The second viewing is even better because when you know that the mom is an accomplice. Then you watch every scene differently. Mm-hmm. I think the way he films Micah is incredible. I love the little smiles that Micah has every once in a while in the film that are very character driven moments for her because she's very serious the entire time. I found her performance to be remarkable.
So is she being manipulated by the ball that's in her doll the entire time?
I don't know. Good question. Whose doll? Micah's doll?
Micah's doll.
Where's Micah's doll?
The mother has it because the mother shoots it open.
Right. Wouldn't that doll have to be in the presence of the person though?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Probably.
So I loved it. I would go see it.
While we're still in spoiler conversation, really quickly before we wrap out, I read a really interesting interpretation of it, which is that the satanic balls are a representation of childhood trauma, some type of childhood trauma that people might have gone through, and that the dolls then encapsulate them in their moment prior to the trauma happening. And that, you know, if you've been through some sort of childhood trauma, people will often say there was like moments before and moments after, like my life was this beforehand and then my life is everything after the fact. I think that Oz Perkins has kind of shot that theory down because what the reading was saying is that, you know, remember in the very beginning when Nicolas Cage is explaining he's got the long legs and he's got to bring himself back down to their level sort of thing. But Oz Perkins has said like, no, the name of Long Legs doesn't have a deeper meaning to it. I just thought it sounded good. He thought it sounded like it had a 70s sort of vibe to it. But reading that interpretation of it, if this is a deeper commentary on childhood trauma, I thought that was really fascinating. I thought that was a pretty interesting read on it, especially with the dolls, you know, how they would almost capture the moment when a person had gone through a childhood trauma.
I find that interesting.
I will say this. Having heard you talk about it, I came out of that movie convinced, like, I'm never going to watch this again. Because the coincidence of the mother being the accomplice drove me nuts. Like, literally, I was like, 5 or 10 minutes before it happened, I was like, please don't be the mom, please. And then it was the mom. But given what you've explained in this conversation, I am willing to give it another shot and go back and see if she's being manipulated the whole time, if that takes me beyond the coincidence of those two.
But it's really interesting.
But I'll say, it, like I said, it's well acted. It's beautifully shot. I was with it the whole time. It's just the reveal of the connection to the mom and her being responsible made me angry.
Yeah.
Made me angry.
I get it.
And my gut reaction. I still went 3 out of 5. It's not like I was like, this is a piece of shit, 1-star movie. Like, I still thought it was well made. I think that's a storytelling flaw that maybe I'm putting too much pressure on. Maybe I'm digging away at it, but.
I loved it.
Good. Kev loved it. This is your call to action. What are your thoughts on Long Legs or Twisters? If you go to see Twisters, but largely, you know, we're split on Long Legs and we want to hear from you guys what you thought. So head to the comments down below. Give us your review of Long Legs. I feel like more people are going to be in Kevin's camp because, you know, right off the bat, I kind of put something on social that I wasn't a huge fan of it. And people are telling me it's an L take and all this jazz. And so I don't know. We'll see how it does. I'm really curious to see what kind of, and I'm sorry, this is no pun intended, what kind of legs it has at the box office. Like, that's a strong opening. And are people going to continue to go back and see it? Is it going to be word of mouth that sort of drives it? It's already a big hit. The budget was only $10 million, I want to say, for it.
Reportedly, so.
10, yeah.
Yeah.
Sean, so you already have your headline for it, though.
What's that?
Will Long Legs have legs or will it get sucked up by Twisters?
Oh, shit, Gabe. Write that down. Yeah. That was fantastic.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. In the meantime, follow us on social media at Sean_O'Connell, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Jake's Takes, at Gabe Kovac, and the show itself is at Real Blend. Gabe, do we have anything we could tease or no? No, everything's kind of,
yeah, we're waiting for it to be # if it happened.
Couple of interesting things in the works. But
yeah.
We'll see. Oh, and then I'll be at San Diego Comic-Con with Gabe.
As will I.
So, yes. So,
if you're there, look for us. You probably won't find us.
Yeah, but please do. If there's any blenders who are going to San Diego, take a look out for us. We'll be there. And appropriately, for that reason alone, let's end the show by shouting out the name. Sean Levy.
Sean Levy.
Come on our show.
Come back.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.